From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. This past week, there was a lot of tension in the East China Sea. China has traded heated diplomatic exchanges with Japan and the United States over Beijing's declaration of an air defense zone. China has set up the air defense identification zone in an area which includes Japan-controlled islands claimed by China, known as the Sakados in Japan and Daios in Chinese. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says it's a dangerous move that could cause serious problems, while the United States has also expressed concern. China has reacted angrily to those remarks, reportedly lodging formal protests with the U.S. and summoning the Japanese ambassador in China. Tom Maddox reports.
Not for the first time, a war of words has erupted between China and Japan over the disputed islands in the East China Sea, known as the Senkakus in Japan and the Diaoyus in China. According to Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, the new air defense zone drawn up by China is unenforceable.
The measures by the Chinese side have no validity whatsoever on Japan, and we demand China revoke any measures that could infringe upon the freedom of flight in international airspace.
Beijing says the new zone, which takes in islands claimed by both Japan and South Korea, is designed to guard against potential air threats. There are rules within the zone. Aircraft are expected to provide their flight plan, to clearly mark their nationality, and to maintain two-way radio communication. If these rules are breached, aircraft risk Chinese military intervention.
Well, I think it comes as a surprise and certainly is a potentially dangerous escalation.
Dr. Jeff Kingston is the Director of Asian Studies at Temple University in Japan.
China has upped the ante, and this really could destabilize relations in the area. Now, obviously, the relationship between Japan and China over the disputed islands in the East China Sea has grown rather ugly over the past year and a half. And this just sort of adds more fuel to the fire. The United States has responded by saying it's going to ignore the new air defense identity zone. Korea has also responded that it overlaps its own zone.
The long-running spat over the tiny uninhabited islands has become a focus of nationalist anger in both nations. For Japan's Shinzo Abe and China's Xi Jinping, Dr. Kingston says keeping this dispute on a low simmer has its political uses. But President Xi has now turned the heat up too much, he says, and the new zone will prove unhelpful for international relations.
The problem is it doesn't really do anything for China strategically. It doesn't help it make its case. It doesn't improve the situation in East China Sea for China's national interest. And what they've done is taken a trilateral relationship, which has grown rather frayed over the last few months between Washington, Seoul, and Tokyo, and managed to pull them together because China is acting in what is seen to be a bellicose manner.
That view isn't shared by one of China's leading international relations specialists. Professor Jia Daojiang from Peking University doesn't believe the situation will escalate militarily. He says the new defense zone established by China will instead work towards conflict reduction. And he says it outlines a better roadmap for civilian authorities to engage with each other.
This identification zone is often misunderstood to be limited to movement of military aircraft. Actually, the practice of setting what's called an air defense identification zone, or ADIZ for short, began in the United States. Japan established its own ADIZ many years ago, and in May this year, Japan expanded its zone westward to be getting closer to the China side. This zone is meant to cover both civilian aircraft movement and military aircraft movement. people too often misunderstand that this has to do with military implications only.
So both parties, Japan and China, that is, have expressed that it's well within their rights to set up these respective zones.
Correct.
What do you think will happen now that China have produced their own plan, their own rules and regulations in the area?
I think it's actually going to be rather straightforward. In other words, the civilian air control authorities of both China and Japan have a clearer roadmap for working together to find out ways of informing each other of their respective flying plans for the respective plans for the passes of the civilian airplanes. And in many ways, this can help freeze up the airspace for use by Chinese airplanes.
An emergency security law has been invoked in the Thai capital Bangkok in a bid to contain escalating anti-government demonstrations. Protesters are demanding the resignation of the Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra and are continuing to occupy government buildings, describing her as a puppet of her fugitive brother Thaksin Shinawatra. Zoe Daniel has more from the Thai capital.
Protesters have targeted 13 locations so far, among them military and police headquarters and five television stations. They've occupied the finance department, but the protest ringleaders have told them not to use any violence or cause any damage, to merely sit in. The finance department has apparently been targeted because the protesters believe that it's under the control of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who was ousted in a coup in 2006 and lives in self-imposed exile. Thaksin's sister, Yingluck, is the current Prime Minister. The protesters also apparently want to block the government's budget, which is why they're sitting in the finance department. However, they've said that they will target further ministries today. At their core, the protests are about toppling the Yingluck administration, but also preventing Thaksin Shinawatra from ever returning to the country. Protest ringleaders say that victory will be complete within 3 days. However, Yingluck stepping down or a house dissolution for a new election would not be adequate. So the question is, what exactly would victory involve? Yingluck has already said that she won't step down, and nor will she call a snap poll. She says that a no-confidence motion that's to be debated today may help ease some of the tension, but that seems unlikely.
UNAIDS is launching a zero-discrimination campaign on World AIDS Day. Last week's Asia-Pacific meeting in Bangkok brought together 4,000 delegates from across the region. But many community groups say the time for talk is over and regional governments must take action. To find out more, our good friend Sen Lam spoke to Malu Marin, the regional coordinator of Seven Sisters, an Asia-Pacific network on HIV/AIDS covering six NGOs and groups.
We've been attending conferences and meetings and workshops and trainings, and we keep talking about the same issues, the same proposals, the same solutions. And sometimes, you know, you can't help but think, is it really changing? Are things really moving forward? And we know that, you know, to a certain extent, the epidemic is, of course, changing. But are the times, you know, able to adjust to those changes, or are we able to adjust our response so that, you know, they keep up with the epidemic? And I think we really need to take stock of what has been done and to reflect, you know, have we really been effective in the response?
Why do you think the response has not been effective? What are the pieces of evidence that convince you that it's not been effective?
Well, cases are rising. You know, for instance, among MSM, in many countries, you know, particularly in concentrated epidemics, the cases are rising. And I can speak about, you know, my experience, for instance, in the Philippines, where, you know, for the longest time, we had really small numbers of people getting infected. And in the last 3 years, it just, you know, started really ballooning. And so, you know, sometimes our reflection on it is that did we peak too early in the response, you know, and now we cannot catch up anymore because it's just moving so fast. But that's really where the issues around funding, the issues around priorities, the issues around legal reforms and political will come into the picture.
At this ICAP meeting, I've been hearing a lot about stigma being a huge hurdle. What, to your mind, is a big hurdle in stemming the spread of HIV infections?
Well, you said it, not stigma and discrimination are big hurdles because they limit people's abilities, they limit people's rights. And
would you say it's the greatest hurdle?
There are many barriers, I think, and it occurs in many levels. So there's stigma discrimination that's more institutional. There's stigma discrimination that's more personal. And I think we really need to address all these different levels because on the one hand, you know, you can keep on doing stigma reduction, educating people, etc. But if the institutions do not change, then it's still going to be problematic.
Do you have any idea, any proposal to put forward?
Yeah, I think institutions can change if, you know, for instance, you're able to put in policies in place. That's one modality. In the Philippines, again, I will go back to the example of the Philippines, that, you know, our government ministries are mandated to come up with an AIDS policy. And not all have complied, but I think a significant number of government agencies have actually complied and have a workplace policy on AIDS, which deals with all of that, deals with issues of treatment, deals with, treatment of people living with HIV, deals with issues of rights, and so, you know, they don't get terminated from work if they're found to be living with HIV, or that mandatory testing is not, you know, a prerequisite for employment. So we have our government agencies who have actually been able to create this policy. So you can tackle it from various fronts. You have the policy, and then you have the attitude, you know, change that you need to have. And you can do it through sensitization trainings and directly involving communities in that. Because I think it's really important that for most, I mean, there are still people who have not met a person living with HIV in many places in the world. And they get so surprised when they see a person who is healthy, who looks like just like them. So we think that 30 years down the line that we've crossed that, but no, it still happens. We all have to be engaged in the response. I think the other institution we also should proactively engage is the media. Because I think media shapes attitudes, and they can also contribute into reducing stigma, you know, by having more positive portrayals, for instance, of people living with HIV.
You're talking about popular media.
Yes, and social media, because then it's so easy. Information.
But not news media, though, because we just report the facts.
Yes, but then you can editorialize. And so this is where the
not me
editors do. So, yeah, and this is where sometimes, you know, it's factual, but then a concluding statement or the title of the article changes the whole perspective. So I think we need to also have that work with the media just to change attitudes.
Do you think these challenges are universal across the Asia-Pacific region, or do you think some countries do it tougher than the others?
I think we're all differently affected and impacted, you know, because I would imagine in some settings that are more closed, it would be more difficult. But it doesn't mean that even in countries like Thailand, which has, you know, blazed the trail and gone far ahead, that discrimination doesn't happen. It still does.
If I may use the Philippines as an example, the Philippines, of course, is a predominantly Catholic nation. Mm-hmm. And yet for all that, my impression is that the public attitudes are fairly liberal. Do you think that's a misunderstanding of Philippine society?
I think it's liberal, but it's liberal from a distance. You know, it's like when it gets to home, when it's your son or your daughter who's a lesbian or gay, it completely changes the picture.
Would have thought that if your son or daughter says that he's gay or lesbian, that you would just love them.
No, it doesn't happen that way. No. It's very easy to accept if it's other people, but if it's your own, it's difficult. So it's problematic that way. Supposedly we're liberal, but our church, well, the institutional church, the Catholic Church, they meddle in the political arena. They do lobbying, they pressure the people in Congress, the district representatives, they pressure the national government. And so I think that needs to be brought to the fore, because the church should, you know, there should be separation between church and state. And our Catholic Church, for some reason, think that they have every right as well to get involved in political matters. And that's where it becomes problematic, extremely problematic.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Myanmar's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi says the time for power to be enshrined to the people to move the country to a democracy should happen soon. She was in Australia this week, where she was asking the Australian government and people to support her to bring democracy back to the country. She spoke to the ABC's Leah Sales in Canberra about her future plans.
Dr. Aung San Suu Kyi, lovely to meet you. In the past couple of years, Myanmar has made some notable political and economic progress. What do you consider to be the greatest challenges to the sustainability of that?
We need to go for genuine democracy, not disciplined democracy as anticipated by the previous regime. And of course, you know that 80% of the members of this government come from the old government.
So by disciplined democracy, do you mean
military? I think what they mean is a democracy that is practiced within the framework of the present constitution, which is not a democratic one.
What's in it for the army to support that, given that it currently enshrines their power?
Well, I think it's time for the army to understand that power should be enshrined in the people if we are to be a genuine democracy and not in any particular institution or organisation.
The Burmese military has shown no reluctance in the past to use violence to crack down on dissent. Is there a risk that in this push to amend the constitution that you could face the same sort of situation again, or are we beyond that now in Myanmar?
I don't think we can say that we're beyond any particular situation, but at the same time, I don't think it's such a great risk either, because times have changed, and I think there are a great number of people within the military who wish to be an army that is honoured and respected and trusted by the people. I don't think they want to see themselves as apart from the people. In the past, in the country, people viewed the situation in very stark black and white terms, the military on one side and the civilian population on the other. And I think increasingly there are people in the military who do not like the situation, who know that this is not desirable for the country.
You have spent your life fighting for democracy. Let's say the constitution is amended, you became the president of Myanmar. What would you then want to do as leader of a democracy?
When we founded the National League for Democracy in 1988, we founded it on three pillars: democracy, human rights, and national reconciliation. And I think these three pillars have yet to be constructed firmly and strongly. So we want to make sure that the democratic institutions are strong and sustainable. And of course, a genuine democracy has to be built on respect and practice of human rights. And national reconciliation is an absolute must. Burma is a country of many ethnic nationalities. The Burmese are just one ethnic nationality, although we are the biggest one. So national reconciliation is something we have not yet achieved. To begin with, reconciliation between the military and the civilian population is very important. We have to learn to trust one another and to understand that together we can build up a country that is at peace and that is secure and prosperous.
Will there be sufficient forgiveness in the country to be able to do that, that people will be able to overlook some of what the military has done?
I think there are some people who will find it hard to forgive. And I don't think this is something that is abnormal or unnatural, because some have suffered under the military regime. I do not have any desire for vengeance, but I also accept that I was treated well. I was placed under house arrest, but that is all. I was not ill-treated the way our people were ill-treated in prison. And while they may have reviled me in the state newspapers, which they did almost on a daily basis at one time, when they came to see me, in any contact I had with the authorities and security forces, they were always respectful. They always behaved very well with me. So I have no reason to wish for vengeance. But I can understand that there would be some who find it unforgivable, who find unforgivable what was done to them over the years. But I think we have to look at the larger picture. We can't concentrate on the emotions of those who wish for vengeance. We have to find a way out of that syndrome of anger for anger, violence for violence. And we have to break out of that. And we have to build our country on the vision we have of the future.
You mentioned earlier that Myanmar is made up of a number of different ethnic nationalities. One of the criticisms that has been made of you recently is that you're not doing enough to stand up for some of those ethnic minorities. What do you say to that?
I think you're probably talking about the Muslim population in the Rakhine and about the Kachin state. Now, let's take the second one first. The Kachin Independence Organization, the KIO, are having official peace talks with the government. And I'm a bit puzzled when I'm told, why am I not criticizing the army? Why am I not speaking up for the Kachins? Isn't this what the KIO is doing directly with the government? When they are engaged in direct peace talks with the government, why are we supposed to then stand up and condemn one side or the other? That might, in fact, derail the peace process, and then we'd be blamed for it. Now, with regard to the situation in the Rakhine, I've always been worried by the fact that focusing so much on the extremist elements within those two communities is going to increase hatred and insecurity. And I would like people who are calling on me to speak out to say, call on the government to establish rule of law. Why has rule of law not been established in Rakhine? If we could put an end to the violence, if we could make sure that there is no further outbreak of violence, we could get those two communities to sort out the differences.
You have made choices in your life that have entailed a degree of personal sacrifice. What do you think has been the hardest thing about the path that you have chosen?
I don't think any particular thing was hard about it. I think once you've made a choice, you've made a choice. And what I think most concerned me was that the political path that my party and I chose should be the right one for our country, because I do believe in honest politics. And because we're starting out on a new road, we have this advantage that we can avoid making too many mistakes. I don't think we can avoid entirely making mistakes, but we can avoid making too many mistakes. And in a sense, instead of looking on it as difficulties or problems, that these are opportunities given to us to build up a genuine culture of democracy. It's not simply democracy as a political system. We need to build up a whole culture of democracy, including negotiated compromise, and the Burmese are not very strong on negotiated compromise.
You inspire many people around the world. Who in turn inspires you?
I'm inspired by people whom perhaps others may not have heard of, simply people who are kind and dedicated, people within my party who have really worked hard to keep our cause going, and of whom nobody has ever heard, the ones I call the unknown soldiers, the soldiers without names. These are the bravest of all because they get no recognition, and they want no recognition. I'm recognized, I'm honored, and I've been very fortunate in gaining the friendship and support of many. But some of our unknown soldiers, people don't even know that they exist, and yet I wouldn't be where I am now without those.
Thank you very much for making time to speak to our audience. It's been so interesting to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure.
Aung San Suu Kyi, Myanmar's opposition leader, speaking to the ABC's Leah Sales in Canberra. Papua New Guinea's government is considering changing the law to enable its citizens to have dual citizenship. The current laws say PNG citizens wanting to apply for citizenship in a foreign country have to renounce their birthright and leave the country. For more reporting from Port Moresby, here's Firmin Nanol.
PNG's Foreign Affairs Minister Rimbing Pato tabled the proposed legislation to allow amendments to the constitution in parliament. He told parliament the law is to enable its citizens to have dual citizenship and children of mixed parentage and other naturalized citizens to become dual citizens.
At the time of independence, we were rightly concerned about a threat that foreign influence opposed to our self-determination. In those years, it made sense to restrict Papua New Guineans from holding any other citizenship. We are now part of a truly international community and interconnected world to which more Papua New Guineans are now having to travel in and out of our country than at any other times in the history of our nation. Mr. Speaker, in the midst of this 21st century, opportunities for Papua New Guineans should not be disadvantaged, because compared to citizens of more than 60 other nations, our mobility to take up new citizenship without automatically losing PNG citizenship does not exist, except that we will permit it to be done by way of this amendment.
A former Prime Minister, Pai Swinty, says the idea and legislation is good, but the executive government must ensure the legislation is not abused. He says the systems and the processes should be tightened so foreigners do not abuse PNG's migration and labor laws, which is something he says happens right now.
The labor department of this country has not fixed up the number of people who are coming into this country, doing jobs that ordinary Papua New Guineans can do. It's a very frightening trend. And I just hope when we pass this bill, we're not going to allow for this young country to have so many people coming into PNG and become citizens easily. Because you can't get that easily in Australia. You can't get it in New Zealand. You can't get that in any other parts of the world. It is not easy. So that is my concern.
During the debate, PNG's Attorney General and Justice Minister Karen Gakua said it's about time PNG had such laws.
You now have an increasing number of Papua New Guinean men marrying foreign women, and they are producing children who are also forced into that scenario, not by choice, but because of the composition of their biological makeup. And perhaps, in my view, too early at 19, they would have to make very, very important decisions affecting their lives. Then you have another group of, a third group of people who are born of both Papua New Guinean parentage, natural citizens, whose children are educated overseas or choose to go and live and work overseas. And they acquire the qualification to be citizens of a foreign country. But then the question pops up again as to whether they should permanently forfeit their own natural citizenship of their own country. They are placed in that crossroads also. So we have these three categories of people. All of these at some point in their life come face to face with this question. So we would need to create some leeway as a parliament. So the proposition now on the floor through the foreign minister is just for the overall constitutional framework that authorizes this kind of scenario to take place.
The chairman of the Parliamentary Committee on Laws and Subordinate Legislations, Solan Misirum, says the committee considered the legislative changes to PNG's citizenship and migration laws to be proper and it should be passed.
The committee considered the fact that the briefing by the PNG Migration and Citizenship Authority is part and parcel of the consultation process. The committee is convinced that the proposed law bill to alter the constitution relating to dual citizenship would provide a win-win situation for the people of Papua New Guinea, as well for those non-Papua New Guineans who wish to become citizens. The committee is also convinced that the very people who will benefit or be affected once this law bill is passed should be given an opportunity to have their say on this bill.
The Parliament Speaker referred the proposed legislation to the Parliamentary Committee on Legislation, awaiting further wider public consultation before it's debated and passed at a later date. Femenano, Port Moresby.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. You can catch another edition Sunday at 1330 UTC. That's for listeners in the Pacific, Southeast Asia, and East Asia on 9335 kilohertz. On behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.